University researchers recruit students and others for experiments to study human behavior. And I'd like us to pretend that we are on some university campus and we are all participating in one of these events. So if you were in one of these university research centers, you'd start out by having the technician read your blood pressure and your pulse. So if you want to, you can do that right now. I would be surprised if you bring blood pressure equipment with you to church, but if you've got it, you can pump it up right now. And all of us, if you want to, you can check your pulse either at your wrist or at your neck. And, you know, I'm pretty good at reading these, so I would, I'm just going to estimate here. Okay, I would say the average here, resting heart rate, pulse, 68 beats per minute. Good. Hold that beat. And blood pressure, well, that's a little bit harder to do, but I'm pretty accurate with this. So I'd say the average blood pressure here is 120 over 80. All right, now are you ready for the experiment? Now that we have the baseline, I want you to think of someone who has really hurt you, someone who has done great injury to you or to members of your family or those whom you love. All right, now I want you to think about ways to get even. Oh, go ahead. Just enjoy it. Think of whatever you could do, as bizarre as you want it to be, to get even with that person who injured you. Okay, hold that thought. We're going to take your blood pressure again here, and we're going to read your pulse, all right? I'm looking at it, the average pulse now, 107. And your blood pressure, the group collective blood pressure, 160 over 110. Because that's what revenge does. Revenge has its physical and psychological and spiritual impact. It's also contagious, revenge is. It extends to families and to communities and to entire nations that catch the revenge bug. And it quickly can become epidemic. In fact, revenge can actually be put in your DNA and passed on to future generations. That's the story here in America of the Hatfields and the McCoys, or in Africa between tribes, or in the Middle East between ethnic groups. That revenge is kind of like a runaway train that just causes havoc for everything in its path. But sometimes there is someone who steps up to break the cycle, someone with great moral courage, who will stop the hate, who will stop what has gone on for generations to get even with those who have done wrong. And that's the way it was with David. David was a morally courageous person. The king of Israel, who happened to be his father-in-law, wanted David dead for no good reason. And so at first he tried to do it himself, tried to kill David with his own spear. But he missed. So he hired assassins to go and look for David, to track him down and to murder him, but they were unsuccessful. So he actually recruited an elite army of 3,000 to hunt down David and make sure that he was killed. Along the way, King Saul took on military officers, killed everybody in an entire town. He went after David's family and friends. He was going to do whatever he needed to do to make sure that David was dead. And then one memorable day, the tables were surprisingly turned. Now, it's sort of a men's room story that the best of fiction writers probably could never think up. Because while Saul was chasing David in the wilderness of Judea, in the mountains there, well, he had to go to the bathroom. And there was no McDonald's with clean restrooms available. And there wasn't a porta potty. And he certainly didn't want to do this in front of his entire army of 3,000. And he saw a cave. And he decided that that's where he would go. Let me just say an aside here. I remember as a boy growing up, I would watch these television programs that were for children or cowboy movies or science fiction stuff. And I remember as a child thinking, they never have to go to the bathroom. And what is the deal there? I mean, I remember thinking that this is not normal and that this is not realistic. Okay, so I will tell you that there are stories in the Bible that are not comfortable, but the Bible is pretty normal and pretty realistic. So here's what we've got in 1 Samuel chapter 24. After Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, David is in the desert of En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. He came to the sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men were far back in the same cave. The men said, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish.'" Then David crept up unnoticed and cut a corner off of Saul's robe. So David and his men were hiding in the back of this cave while there are 3,000 soldiers out there looking for them. So they had to be very quiet to make sure that they were undetected. And then, frighteningly, they heard someone coming. And they knew that they were trapped. But good news, it wasn't a search party. It was only one person. So be really quiet so that word doesn't get out. But, you know, there's always somebody that has to peek and see. And one of them looked to see what was going on, and it was the king. The king was in the same cave. They were amazed. It must have seemed as if it were just too good to be true. This was a gift from God. And so David's men whispered to him, "David, you do it. You do the honors. Kill the king in his embarrassing position and get even with him. Get even with him for the crimes that he has committed, for the threats that he has made. Cut off his head." That's what you did with Goliath the giant. Cut off the king's head, hold it by the hair, walk out of the cave, show it to his army, and you can claim the throne. You can take the crown. You can do it today. So David stepped lightly, quietly, dagger in hand. It would be swift and it would be final. The king would be dead in less than a minute. And I think that for David, maybe it felt very good, because revenge often feels really good. His knife was razor sharp. He lifted it. But he didn't lift it high. He lifted it low. And he cut a piece of cloth off of the king's clothes instead of cutting the king's throat. And then softly he stepped back, not with the king's head in his hand, but instead with a piece of fabric in his hand. David could have killed the king, and he didn't. And in that moment, he broke the cycle of hatred and of revenge. He spared a human life. In that moment, David was a great moral hero. He demonstrated dazzling courage and righteousness. And he felt rotten. And his conscience seized him. David didn't feel good about sparing the king. Actually, he felt awful about having cut this little piece of cloth off of the king's robe. Afterward, David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. He said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lift my hand against him, for he is the anointed of the Lord. With these words, David rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went his way. Now, on that day, David looked so noble, so generous. And if he had just kept his mouth shut, no one would ever know anything different. He was magnanimous. He was forgiving. He didn't seek revenge. He had purity of heart. But in those days, a king's robe was the symbol of power and authority and royalty. And to go and to cut a piece off the king's robe was to humiliate the king, to humble him, to say that David was in a position of power and authority, that he held the king's life in his hands. And even more than that, that he was in a position where he could slice away at the kingdom until eventually he could take it for himself. David knew all of the symbolism with the cloth that he held in his hand, and he was conscience stricken because he knew his own heart. He read his own motives. He had manipulated the situation to make himself look very good when the truth was that in his heart he was mean-spirited and manipulative. Maybe you've done that. I have. Where you sort of control the circumstances to make yourself look terrific without admitting to what's really going on in your heart and in your head. So I've been there. I know what David felt. The bad news is that David did what he did. The good news is that he had a heart for God in this. He wasn't perfect. And the Bible does not present him as perfect. But when he did what he did, regret was instant. His conscience was stricken. And so it is no wonder that he is later described in the New Testament in Acts 13:22 as a man after God's own heart. A man after God's own heart, not because he did something that he shouldn't have done, not because of his wrong thoughts and actions, but a man who had a heart for God, whose conscience was quick to acknowledge when he was sinful. Now, David was a poet and a songwriter, and I am neither, so I can only imagine how he got to the words that he wrote of one of the Psalms. A poet and a songwriter. You know, you go to a stage play or you watch a musical movie, and I don't know how people do this. They're in some circumstance that is unexpected, and immediately they break out in song with full orchestration and everything rhymes. And I think, well, I don't know. Do they really think they can do that? Or is it something that is written down later on? Did David at the moment there in the cave actually think up the music and the words, or did he later sit down with pen and parchment and instrument and write the words of Psalm 57? You know, the Bible is not a chronological book. It's actually a library of a lot of books. And there is a history section from which we are reading in 1 Samuel 24. And there is a music section to the library that is called the Bible. And that is the book of Psalms. And in it is a psalm that scribes, editors, added a beginning explanation to set the circumstance. They also use musical terms which I do not understand. So Psalm 57 in our Bibles, at the beginning of it, has the editorial comment, "For the director of music, to the tune of Do Not Destroy, of David, Miktam, when he had fled from Saul into the cave." This is what David thought. This is what David sang. "Have mercy on me, O God. Have mercy on me, for in you my soul takes refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed. I cry out to God Most High, to God who fulfills his purpose for me. He sends from heaven and saves me, rebuking those who hotly pursue me. Selah," which is a rest. Stop and think about it. God sends his love and his faithfulness. I'm in the midst of lions. I lie among ravenous beasts, men whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. They spread a net for my feet. I was bowed down in distress. They dug a pit in my path, but they have fallen into it themselves. My heart is steadfast, O God, my heart is steadfast. I will sing and make music. Awake, my soul. Awake, harp and lyre. I will awaken the dawn. I will praise you, O Lord, among the nations. I will sing of you among the peoples. For great is your love, reaching to the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the skies. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. When, like David, you say things that you shouldn't have said, do things that you shouldn't have done, may your conscience be quickly stricken, and may your response be to hastily make things right. And when you do like David in the song he wrote to reflect on the experience in that cave, may you seek God's mercy and forgiveness, and may you praise God for having saved your skin. Saul left that cave. He never actually knew what happened. And he climbed down from the cave to rejoin the 3,000 men that he had recruited. And David then stepped out of the cave and shouted to Saul and to the entire army, took them all totally by surprise. They were the ones that were pursuing him. And David was the one who was fleeing, and now he was right there in front of them. Certainly out of an army of 3,000, there had to be at least one or two that could outrun David, and he would be caught. So they were shocked that this fugitive actually volunteered himself and made himself vulnerable. What David did was he gave a speech for Saul, but a speech for thousands to hear. And it's not an angry speech. It's not a vengeful speech. David had been deeply hurt by false accusations. They had turned things upside down. They had accused him of treason. It simply wasn't true. And he had tried to defend himself at every turn. But here was an opportunity to prove to his critics that he was not motivated by treason or any disloyalty to the king. And he was willing to risk his life in order to get the story straight. Then David went out of the cave and he called out to Saul, "My lord, the king!" And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He said to Saul, "Why do you listen when men say David is bent on harming you? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not lift my hand against my master because he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. Now understand and recognize that I am not guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you're hunting me down to take my life. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs that you have done to me. But my hand will not touch you. As the old saying goes, from evildoers come evil deeds, so my hand will not touch you. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom are you pursuing? A dead dog? A flea? May the Lord be our judge and decide between us. May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me by delivering me from your hand." Have you ever been misunderstood? You really meant well, but some critics turned it upside down and inside out to make it sound as if you meant exactly the opposite. You did everything you could to show kindness and generosity, and they said that you were greedy and cruel. You tried to explain, and they took your words and turned them into something that you never imagined anyone could construe that you would think of or say. And so, you know, what David felt. David, that day, had an opportunity to set the record straight. And he did it with civility and kindness, forgiveness and graciousness toward the man who had vilified him and tried to kill him. You know, throughout this story, as we have been studying the biography of David, we have increasingly discovered that Saul was a madman. He was crazy. This guy was out of control. He was irrational and ungodly and vicious. He used the power of his office in the ugliest and most illegal of ways. But when David spoke to him with kindness and graciousness, when David broke this cycle of hatred and revenge, grace and reason returned to this otherwise crazy king. When David finished saying this, Saul asked, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" And Saul wept aloud. "You are more righteous than I," he said. "You have treated me well, but I've treated you badly. You have just now told me of the good that you did to me. The Lord delivered me into your hands, but you did not kill me. When a man finds his enemy, does he let him go away unharmed? May the Lord reward you well for the way you treated me today. I know you will surely be king and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands. Now swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's family." So David gave his oath to Saul. And then Saul returned home, but David and his men went up to their stronghold. So that day, Saul was gracious and humble and insightful. He admitted what he had done wrong. He admitted his misbehavior. He acknowledged the providence of God, that God was repeatedly saving David's life and keeping Saul away from him. And he admitted something that politically he had never, never admitted to before, at least not on the record. And that is, he knew where God was taking all this, that God was going to make David the king of Israel instead of him. And he knew what the practice was of ancient Middle Eastern kings, that when that happened, they killed everybody in the family of their predecessor. And so politically, he admitted that David would become the king, and he begged David to not slaughter his family, as was the custom. And David promised. That wasn't who David was. He took an oath to preserve the family of King Saul. And then they went to their different homes. Saul was transformed. So what does that mean to us? Does that mean then when people treat us rotten, when they are vicious and vindictive, that if we will be kind and gracious and polite, if we will speak with civil terms, that we will instantly transform them and they will forever be different? Well, it doesn't mean that. And Saul, was he permanently this way? Was that day of transformation carried into the future? Unfortunately, he did not remain rational and meek. But the teaching for us is to be like David, to break the cycle of hatred and revenge. The teaching is the same as the teaching of Jesus. Listen to his words as recorded in the New Testament in Luke chapter 6. Jesus said, "I tell you who hear me, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. If someone takes your cloak, do not stop him from taking your tunic. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners, expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, because He, God, is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Chances are that you have been, or that you soon will be, in a cave. Your back to the wall. No escape, no way out. And that God will intervene and save you, maybe at the last moment. And there may well be in that cave or just outside the mouth of that cave an opportunity for you to have revenge, for you to get even, for you to inflict on your enemy the very evil that your enemy sought to inflict upon you. And that will be the moment to demonstrate faith and character. So when that opportunity for revenge comes, remember what Jesus said and remember what David did. God help us in that moment to break the cycle of hatred and revenge, to do that which is uncharacteristic of our history or of our times. Help us to do what Jesus said. Help us in an opportunity for revenge to do what David did. We pray in Jesus' name.